probability rho that we can have a particle with momentum in the neighborhood of P and position in the neighborhood of R. I point out to you that this kind of thing is called this kind of thing in which we write rho of P of R is called e to the minus beta h. This is called by mathematicians a Gibbs measure, and by physicists a Boltzmann or Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Whatever it is, it's a rather simple looking function and has a simple result in which this probability distribution is an exponential of the momentum squared divided by 2m plus the a potential if we have a situation in which we have a single particle in equilibrium in a potential u. Then we talked about how you determine the partition function of the single particle. And now what we're going to do is start picking up on how you calculate averages and sums. The average of any function of P and R is the integral over P and R of this probability distribution, rho of P and R, times that function. It's the same rule as we used for dice. You add up all possibilities. You put down the probability of that, and you then multiply that probability by the amount you get, and you find out you have an average. Imagine that there are n particles in this system, each one moving in equilibrium with a in the potential u of r, and these particles are otherwise independent of one another, that is, that they have no potential of interaction between them. And since there are n independent particles in the system, then what we would have to do to calculate the total amount of anything is to take n times the amount for one particle. That is, what we might want to do is take an f of p and r, which is n times the probability distribution of P and R, and that is called the distribution function. The total amount of quantity represented by G of P of R when we have these n particles is the total amount of G is the integral dP and R times F of P and R times G of P and R, or since F is n times rho, that's the amount, average amount of G. It's the average of G times the n, and that, this is kind of simple-minded stuff. For example, we calculated the average energy for one particle in this kind of situation as 3/2 kT, and that's this integral over here. And the total energy in this n particle system is 3/2 n kT, which is this integral here. Like anything else, once you get started, you can make it somewhat richer. And we're going to look at a richer example in a moment. But before we do a richer example, we'll go back to an example with extreme poverty. That is, you start out, the simplest thing you can say is the total amount of any of the total amount of anything, that is, the average of 1 is equal to 1. The integral dP of R of rho of P and R is equal to 1. And the same thing for the distribution function, since the distribution function is n times rho, the same thing for the distribution function is n. So let me put on the board F is n times rho, and this will enable us to proceed. Okay, this is said to be a normalization condition for the distribution function, and this is said to be a normalization condition for the probability. Now let's calculate the total pressure. The pressure is defined as the total momentum transfer to a wall per unit of area and a unit of time. So here's a wall, and here are a bunch of particles coming along. Particle hits the wall and bounces back. Let's talk about a unit of time, dt. And then all of the particles with momentum, px, that is with velocity px over m, less than distance less than the distance from the wall should be less than, so that's a distance, let's call this distance z. Z should be less than the velocity, and then these guys will hit the wall. If z is less than px over m times dt, or dz is less than or equal to px over m times dt, these guys will hit the wall. So we can calculate the total number of guys hitting a wall of area dA. Please don't ask me to draw a two-dimensional wall. I can manage a one-dimensional one rather nicely. You can imagine that I drew a pretty box in there. So all of the guys within the area dA and standing within this distance will hit the wall. So this is the number of guys that hit the wall, which we have to have the condition that px is greater than 0. If a particle hits the wall and bounces back, it transfers momentum to px to the wall. And so the total momentum transferred to the wall in the time dt, at least to the piece of wall with area dA, is the total number of guys that are hitting times the momentum that is that each one gives, and is this integral. With, once again, the condition that px is greater than 0. If you want to drop that condition, you knock out this factor of 2, since there are as many guys with px less than 0 as there are with guys greater than 0. That's an integral over all momenta would give a result twice as large. And in the end, we get the result that the pressure, which is the momentum transferred per unit of time, per unit of area, is going to be equal to the integral of px over m times f of p and r times px squared over m. And when you take the value of f of p and r that we had on the previous transparency, the value given us by Maxwell and Boltzmann, we get the pressure is going to be equal to the number of particles per unit volume. Aha! Now we got caught in a big error. There is something left out here. What is left out here is that in order to get the number of the guys that hit the wall the number of guys that hit the wall, I have to put in a factor of the density. I'm sorry, that's the density right there. Sorry. The error is going to be PV is NKT. Where is the V? Horace. The pressure per is going to be proportional. Let's go back. We're going to have to get this right, and I'm not getting it right here. So I'm going to be apologetic. and say that the right answer is not nkt, but it's pv is nkt, and pv is nkt. So this n is the number per unit volume, and something's gone wrong. I'm going to have to get that right. So. So you integrate dr, you get a v. Saved by my colleague from the Caribbean. Thank you. So pv is nkt, and then as we knew it would be, and sure. Is the flicker more visible to you than it is to me? Is that the problem?
Yeah, but
because I couldn't see what was going wrong. Okay. I had my own problems, but they weren't problems of flicker. So let me back up a step, feeling very embarrassed, but not talk for a moment about what the pressure is all about. First of all, I'd like to go back and talk about the stress tensor, which is one piece of what you guys were doing in field theory and general relativity that I can make contact with. The stress tensor, called Tij, is if we have a system moving past us with a velocity v, is m times, I made this consistently the same error. This is m times rho. This is m times the density times vi times vj, plus the delta ij times the pressure. That is, the stress tensor is related to the pressure that is you see in a system. This is what happens in equilibrium. If we have non-equilibrium stuff, it is somewhat different. I'm feeling too embarrassed about this. Let me go escape. I escaped, so why don't I come back to, here we go. So right in here, there should be density. I would put down a rho, but to find my Greek letters is a major effort, so I'll write density times vi times vj. How come we find the pressure in thermodynamics? That is, in the thermodynamics, we more or less said that the derivative, the change in the partition function, or rather in the log of the partition function, was going to be the pressure times the change of volume divided by kT. And this sign is a slight mystery to me. But result, the rest of this is right. How come the pressure comes out of thermodynamics? Do you remember how the pressure works itself into thermodynamics? How come we have a change in the energy, which is going to be given by this? OK. You do some work. And thermodynamics comes back in the end to the science of grinding cannons. That is, it comes down in the end to how you do work on things and how, by changing their volume, you change the energy. And that's how the pressure enters into thermodynamics. How did the pressure enter into the considerations of classical field theory? Where did the stress tensor come in classical field theory? Anybody want to tell me? Come on, you guys just did classical field theory. I was there. What is the stress tensor?
The result of conservation.
Good, that's one answer. that is a result of conservation. I'm a result of evolution, however you want to have some slightly more detail than that.
Well, it's associated with the conservation with respect to each coordinate.
With respect to each coordinate, okay. Now, if I had a conservation law of the form D something or other, density of something or other, plus the divergence of something or other equals zero, what do I put in for something or other? Okay, I'll buy. No, I won't buy. You'll buy.
So, I suppose this isn't related, but like we know.
No, I'm going to do what's related. Come on.
I'm going to do
what's related. Don't push me off here. I want to make sure that we figure out where the pressure comes from.
That's what I wanted to try to say.
Okay, so it is related.
Yeah.
Don't say that it's not related.
It's not related to this, but no report. So we know in classical mechanics, or classical electrodynamics, first of all, that like if you kick an electron, the electron stops moving. And so energy has been lost. So the classical field has to have energy to take care of the conservation. And in the same way, if you shoot like a laser at like a big sheet of aluminum foil in space, the foil will start to move. So in the same way, and you know, the electric field disappears.
Okay, well, come on, there's a simple answer. How does the stress tensor enter into the considerations of classical field theory? What is conserved when we're talking about the stress tensor?
Momentum and energy?
Vp plus div dot t equals zero. P being, among many, many uses for the same symbol, this being the momentum. Mom, if you know her. This is the time derivative of the momentum plus the divergence of the stress tensor equals zero. Stress tensor enters then into classical mechanics through the equation of the conservation of momentum. T is the current for momentum. It is how momentum is carried along. That's how it enters into the classical considerations. Now, let's come back. We find the pressure in thermodynamics because we find the stress tensor in thermodynamics, because we find, in fact, in the thermodynamic considerations that we do work on the system. Here we find this as a conservation law. We just calculated the pressure as something at the walls of the container. How did that work out?
It didn't depend on the shape of the walls or the area, it was the property that.
Okay, that's good.
Intrinsic, right? It's not.
Okay, let's. This sentence is not random. How come we calculate the electrical current at the end of a wire? Here's a wire.
Because of the equation of continuity? Because of the equation of continuity, which states that you can't create charge, it has to, if there's a volume, it has to, what the change in charge is, the sum of the things going in and out.
Fine. That's great. That's the right answer. We can calculate the current as it comes into my computer. We can calculate it as it comes out of the wall. We can calculate it at any point in the wire, and it's always the same because we're not accumulating. We're not accumulating a charge in the wire. Similarly, the fact is that if we have a situation in which we're not accumulating momentum anyplace, the stress tensor has a zero derivative. That means that the stress is sort of the same as you go along. That means you can calculate the pressure or the stress at the walls of the container or anyplace else. We just calculated at the wall because it's convenient to think about momentum being transferred to the wall. But we can calculate it any place in the box. my point, which I'm going to try to make again and again, is that all physics is the same physics, that when we're doing these calculations, we're doing the same calculations as you're doing in general relativity or in quantum field theory, except in a little bit different context. Okay, one more physical quantity which I wanted to stress, which is the entropy. The partition function is the sum over all variables of e to the minus beta h. For a large n, it can be interpreted as w, which is a number of configurations, times an expectation of minus beta times an average energy, w being the number of configurations. Boltzmann got w in terms of the entropy as the logarithm of w is s over k. Boltzmann actually, in order to get this formula, played around with this distribution function f. And he got a relationship between f and entropy. In fact, there's a logarithm, f, in there someplace. I'd like you to think a little bit about how the logarithm of f enters and how the signs enter into this relation. What is the right relationship between entropy and f log f? In fact, I'd like you to be thinking about what Boltzmann thought about some, how the number of configurations and f work together to produce an entropy.
Can you
listen?
Go back to that slide. Sorry.
No, it's perfectly easy for me. Which one do you want? There are three of them today so far.
The one that we were just on with the entropy.
Okay. Sorry.
Chris, you know it's online.
Yeah. Sorry.
I really would like you to get the sign right and to think about the quantities. This is the. Somehow related to f log f. This is a correct statement. That is, that we calculate f as we calculate the entropy in terms of the partition function. And what does it do with f? How does it work in terms of that f?
I think some of the students cannot read on that part of the board.
Okay, can I do anything about that? I escape. I then roll down. And have I solved that problem? Yes, sort of, semi. You can't read the stuff in green, that's okay, it's perfectly fine.
From behind the blackboard, the black, not the screen, the blackboard.
We wrote F, L, and F over here.
That's kind of a.
Okay, it's a blackboard I can't deal with. Fine. Practical problems all over the place. Now, the window, and we come to part three, and we go to the play, So far we've done a statistical mechanics by doing probabilities, by looking basically at one thing at a time. And now I want us to start talking about lattices, that is, about things that are distributed in space and how those things that are distributed in space have a connection with statistical mechanics. In fact, when I talk about connection between things distributed in space and statistical mechanics and quantum mechanics, so it behooves me to remind you about quantum mechanics. And from my point of view, here is all the quantum mechanics on one slide. Quantum mechanics starts out with a Hilbert space, which you can describe as a complete set of states. Here's the statement that you have a complete set of states. It starts out working with a sum over states. For example, that the trace of something is the diagonal sum over all states of that thing. And it doesn't matter what representation we use, that is, whether we're working in momentum or coordinate representation or whatever that Q means, any complete set of states gives the same trace. We can do things in the Schrodinger representation, which is not something that I dearly love, or we can do things in the Heisenberg representation, in which we have the basic quantum mechanical operators here called P. P is a symbol, I guess, which we're going, which was used for everything, from pressure to momentum to here's a quantum mechanical operator, which is e to the minus I Hamiltonian times time times P times e to the I ht. This Hamiltonian is the quantum mechanical Hamiltonian operator. This is the quantum mechanical operator P of T. And if I say what I'm talking about, it will be, I hope, clear what I'm talking about. The partition function for a quantum mechanical problem is given in terms of the quantum mechanical time development operator. The time development operator is here written as T divided as a function of time, which is e to the minus I h time. The partition function is the trace of this time dependent of this time development operator, same time development operator as in the Heisenberg representation, at the funny time minus I beta. Trace, if we do it in a representation in which the energy is diagonal, becomes a sum over all states. Here's another use for the symbol alpha. Alpha, and now we're summing over all quantum mechanical eigenvalues of the energy. Sum over alpha of e to the minus beta times the energy at, of the in the eigenstate alpha. The reason you get e to the minus beta is that minus I times minus I is minus 1, and so that when you take the trace of this time-dependent operator, you get e to the minus beta times the energy. The average of anything in quantum mechanics is the trace of the time-development operator at time minus I beta times that Q divided by Z of beta. I guess that what I'm talking about here is the quantum average of the operator Q, but it is also the statistical average in the ensemble described by the Gibbs or the Boltzmann distribution. If I wanted to talk, and this is sort of as far as I will go in talking about time differences, if I wanted to talk about two operators at two different times, here's the definition of the time of an operator. If I wanted to talk about the quantum mechanical and statistical average of this product, I take the trace of the time development operator times the quantum operator at time s times the quantum operator at time t and divide by the partition function. This trace is precisely this trace. If I wanted to do things in the grand canonical ensemble, most of you know what the grand canonical ensemble is. I will tell you in a few words. The grand canonical ensemble is used in situations when we have not a fixed number of particles, but a number of particles which we're summing over, and the number of particles is defined by a parameter called the chemical potential. We would then use, instead of H minus mu n in our time development operator. That doesn't give us a big deal change. And then we would go on and do things like this and this with that grand canonical ensemble. So that's all of quantum statistical mechanics arrayed in front of you. The rest is details. I will fill in a few more details. Questions? Comments? Okay.
Did you have the same
with Hodgkin's? No, that doesn't go on. I'm not going to do that for another 10 slides, 15 slides. We can wait. You'll have to wait. Okay. From the magnificent to the tiny, I'm going to start out by looking at a tiny little problem involving the simplest thing you could possibly do in space. Ordinary statistical mechanics, no quantum mechanics. I'm going to talk about a bunch of sites labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 along a line in space. I'm going to talk about each site having a variable called Q on it. And I'm going to then talk about how you would calculate the partition function for this whole bunch of things. As I've emphasized several times, once you calculate the partition function, you can calculate anything you want. So once we've done that, we have solved this first baby problem on the behavior of things in space. So what we want to do is sum over the Qs that are at each one of these lattice sites. Here's the Q at the first lattice site and Q at the second lattice site. I want to think of the simplest possible problem, and that simplest possible problem is one in which we have interactions between a lattice site and its nearest neighbor. So here we would have an interaction W between W of Q4 and Q5. Here's a W of Q1 and Q2, a W of Q2 and Q3. I will play one tiny game just to make things neater in the calculation. I will put a bond, that is a W, connecting the nth lattice site with the first, so that instead of really having things on a chain like this, instead things are really arranged on a circle like that. And then I would say that we have the sum of this kind, and that sum with a final term W of Qn and Q1 is the partition function. It says here what I just said. Notice that we've tied the two ends of the lattice to one another via a coupling W. We've essentially used periodic boundary conditions. Now I'm going to convert this into a quantum mechanical calculation. This is the definition following Feynman of a path integral. That is, I will just define a operator T such that Q T P is E to the W of Q and P. This is a definition. This is a definition of a quantum mechanical operator T. I can define any operator I want by defining its matrix elements. And once I have done that, I can rewrite this expression for the partition function. Now, it's wicked for me to rewrite things, so I will put it up on the board here again so we can see what we have. Z is the sum of Q1 up to Qn of e to the w of Q1, Q2, plus dot, 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 w, Qn, Q1. This is the partition function. And now, instead of writing e to the w, I will write Q1 t Q2 here. Nothing whatsoever has happened except for this tiny bit of notation. T is also a time development operator. In a funny sense. You can over my shoulder, thank you. Okay, but all I did, instead of giving things a name, all I did was rewrite the partition function as I said I was going to here, right there. Nothing has happened except that we have now gone from a statistical mechanics problem to a quantum mechanics problem. In that, this is a quantum mechanics defines the problem of multiplying two operators, T and S, by one another by taking the matrix element of the product between Q1 and Q3 as a sum over Q2 of Q1 T Q2 times Q2 S Q3. You will see at once that the partition function is nothing but the product of these n operators, and in fact is the trace, some diagonal sum over Q1 of the product of these n operators, so that the partition function of this one-dimensional statistical mechanics problem is precisely the quantum trace of this operator T, which I didn't want to call the time development operator, but was forced to, the time development operator raised to the nth power. In order to get something familiar, imagine that T is somebody tell me where I put the eraser. I put the, there it is. Good. I carefully did not write down anything called the Hamiltonian for the statistical mechanics problem. That's because I wanted to save the Hamiltonian for writing this time development operator, as I always can, as E to the minus tau times some Hamiltonian H. And this thing is a quantum Hamiltonian. I've just defined the quantum Hamiltonian in that fashion. And if, in fact, this operator is a positive definite, then this H will be real. And this H will be real. In fact, it will be Hermitian. So that if I had, if I insisted that W was real and symmetric, I would be defining in this way a Hamiltonian. So imagine that we defined in this way an e to the minus tau. Tau is just some number which I've invented, times H, where H is a Hamiltonian, which was defined in terms of that W, that original problem that we set for ourselves in terms of the one-dimensional statistical mechanics problem. In fact, of course, this time development operator is just express something at the time minus I tau. If we rewrite the trace in terms of eigenvalues, the trace is the sum over alpha of the exponential of e to the minus n, the number of things we're multiplying, times tau, times the energy of that Hamiltonian. So let's go forward one step and see what we have. Z was originally defined in that fashion, or in a more compact notation. When we translated it into quantum terms, there's the trace of an exponential of e to the minus h n tau. In fact, the word trace might have been used in two different ways. I used the trace in the top line to represent a sum over q's, and I used the trace in this line to represent a statistical, a quantum mechanical sum. The trace in equation 410, which you'll find in the book, is a statistical sum. The trace here is a quantum mechanical trace. I'll use a capital T when I want to emphasize that I'm summing over lots of variables, and a small t when I'm summing over one or a few. The point of all of this argument is that there's a direct translation from one-dimensional quantum mechanics from one-dimensional statistical mechanics into ordinary, plain, everyday quantum mechanics. Every quantum mechanical trace can be converted of this sort, can be converted into a one-dimensional statistical mechanics summation and vice versa. No. Every quantum mechanical trace can be converted into a one-dimensional statistical mechanics summation. Vice versa doesn't quite exactly work, because I had to have nearest neighbor interactions. Okay, this is not something I invented. This is Feynman's path integral. Feynman showed how to convert problems in quantum mechanics into path integrals. Essentially, we just put his path integral on a one-dimensional lattice and converted the integral into a sum. What I said on the previous transparency and it is, and I repeat, every quantum mechanical trace can be converted into a one-dimensional statistical mechanics problem, and vice versa under some conditions like nearest neighbor interactions. More generally, d-dimensional quantum mechanics converts into d plus one-dimensional statistical mechanics. Here we did zero-dimensional quantum into one-dimensional statistical mechanics. The idea about going up and back between the two disciplines is due to Feynman. Here's a picture of Feynman and his invention of the path integral. As far as I know, Feynman never exactly said the sentence written in blue. The point was taken up by Kenneth Wilson in his invention of the modern renormalization group. I guess I mentioned renormalization group now in slide number, I can't read the slide number, but now in slide number 5 or so. So I got to it quicker than I told you. But it will come up again in a more explicit way. Yes, please.
What do you mean by the dimensionality of the quantum mechanics problem? A lot of different ways of interpreting that. Do you mean the number of spatial dimensions?
Instead of answering your question directly, I will answer it indirectly. Imagine I was doing what is indisputably a two-dimensional statistical mechanics problem. Two-dimensional because I have to draw lots of dots on the blackboard. And imagine that I have nearest neighbor interactions between different things on this lattice. what I am arguing is that by grouping up all of these variables together and then going this way, you can take this one-dimensional problem, which you can now express as a quantum mechanics problem, and convert it into a two-dimensional statistical mechanics problem. That is, quantum mechanics on a 1D lattice converts into stat mech on a 2D lattice.
That's because the intermediate states that we're summing over collapse down.
You got it. It's a question of doing the summation of the intermediate states. Right on. OK. There's Feynman looking as a bit of a joker. Characteristic pose. Feynman started out by looking at the simplest and most fundamental problem in quantum mechanics, a Hamiltonian, which is p squared over 2m plus a potential. This is a particularly tricky case. I will write down an answer for this, but I'm not going to feel real comfortable about it. I'm going to argue that, in fact, we can do this particular quantum problem by looking at a variable Q, which is a honest-to-goodness kind of quantum version of a position variable. Q goes from minus infinity to infinity. We'll stick with units in which h bar equals 1. And I will assert without proof that for many purposes, the time development operator, that is the honest to goodness e to the minus IHT evaluated, T is equal to minus I tau. That converts this wiggly thing into a thing which is real. It's called a wick rotation, what I did. And it then makes for life, it makes life a little bit easier on the mathematical side. The h being p squared over 2m plus u, and tau being small. Then if I take matrix elements of this blessed thing between q and q prime, which are eigenstates of position, I then get something which is well represented by e to the minus m times q minus q prime squared over 2 tau minus tau times u of q for small values of tau. Because tau is small, the only contributions to anything come when q and q prime are close to one another. Therefore, I could have written u of q or u of q prime or u of q plus q prime over 2 in the analysis without making huge mistakes. The choices are close to equivalent, but they're not precisely the same. And that's because the p and the q don't commute. And calculating matrix elements like this is a little tricky. This is something you might want to do for yourself. Imagine we wish to know the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian H, that is, of this Hamiltonian. We want to solve a problem in ordinary quantum mechanics. We could, for example, numerically calculate the integral of products of matrix elements like that. as the number of steps goes to infinity, we would, as we calculate the product, be calculating this sum, the sum over alpha, e to the minus n times tau times the energy eigenvalue alpha. And by doing that calculation, this calculation of this numerical calculation of traces of products, we would in fact be doing a numerical calculation of the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian. This approach provides a powerful method for both numerical and analytic approaches to quantum problems. I won't do this case here. It's this business about the commutation of P and Q, the momentum and position operators, provides with a little trickiness, which I don't want to deal with. Instead, I will go back and deal with a problem that I know very well how to play with. I will breathe for a few minutes. I don't doubt it. That is, thank you. Yes. I made a mistake in the convention to begin with. I then corrected the mistake almost every place, but not there. Who did this? Okay. Score a point. Substantial error. Not as big as the lack of an omega, but not the lack of a volume, but a substantial error. Okay. I'm going to go on and calculate a problem where I don't have any problems about small terms and lack of commutation and this and that. I'm going to do an Ising linear chain. Everything will turn out to be, well, complicated enough for us, even on the Ising linear chain. This is not a simple calculation. Feynman's concept of path integral is not a simple concept. The results are hard to hold in your mind. At least I find it hard to hold in my mind. The results are profound. If someone walked up to you on the street in your senior year and told you that you could solve any quantum problem you wanted by doing one-dimensional statistical mechanics, you wouldn't necessarily believe them. But let's go on and do a problem here. I'm going to be taking a bunch of spins, sigmas, not real spins, but Ising spins, along a line. Sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4. I'm going to have an interaction between nearest neighbor spins, which is of the form e to the k sigma sigma prime. That is, the thing I called w before is k times sigma prime. This is what is called the Ising model on a one-dimensional lattice. And what we're going to be calculating then is the partition function of the Ising model, a sum over sigma 1 and sigma 2 and so forth of e to the k sigma 1 sigma 2 plus k sigma 2 sigma 3 plus dot, 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 dot. I'm now going to want to rewrite this in terms of some quantum mechanics problem. And the quantum mechanics problem is going to be represented in terms of the Pauli spin operators. These spin operators do not have the most direct connection in the world with sigma 1, sigma 2, etc. But here, at least, the notation will be reasonably clear. I will use taus for the Pauli spin operators. 1 is the 2x2 matrix unity. Tau 1 is the matrix conventionally called tau 1, which is this matrix with off-diagonal elements in it. Tau 2 is the same thing, anti-symmetric with i's in it. Tau 3 is 1 minus 1 on the diagonal 0, 0. And going up and back, we're going to have to think a little bit. We can represent anything like e to the w of sigma, sigma prime, as some sort of matrix. That's how we did the original definition. And now here it comes. So let me, I have on the board e to the k sigma, sigma prime. And that is e to the k times 1 plus sigma, sigma prime over 2, plus e to the minus k times 1 minus sigma, sigma prime over 2. You don't believe me. I will tell you. If sigma is equal to sigma prime, this is e to the k, and that's this term. If sigma is unequal to sigma prime, this is e to the minus k, and that's this term. In the definition of tau 1 is let's go to the next slide. The definitions of one are that the first, the unit operator is, the unit matrix is delta sigma sigma prime. The thing tau one is the off diagonal object. I need my stick. Tau one is the off diagonal object in which sigma is different from sigma prime always. And in which we have plus ones when sigma is different from sigma prime. If sigma is equal to sigma prime, we get 0. Tau 2 is this beast, and tau 3 is that beast. Tau 3 is diagonal in the sigma representation. Conversely, tau 1 has only off-diagonal elements. This time development operator, which is this guy, or this guy, is 1 plus sigma, sigma prime over 2 times e to the k, 1 minus sigma, sigma prime over 2 times e to the minus k, which, without having my arm disappear up my sleeve for a moment, is e to the k times the unit operator plus e to the minus k times tau 1. Here, the things in bold are these guys. And they have defined an equation 4.19b in the book. We can also write the results as an exponential. I'm just carrying out the series of calculations which was described in formal terms in the definition of the path integral. So now, I will write this guy, which we just said was e to the k times the unit operator. Oh, now I would have liked to have had colored chalk. Well, I'll do this in boldface. E to the k times the unit operator plus e to the minus k times tau 1. In boldface. I'm going to write this as e to the minus h, or e to the minus h times tau 1, but tau 1 will be invisible because it's 1. In fact, no tau 1. We've used up the symbol tau for other things. So I'm just going to write that as e to the minus h. And h has two terms in it, because this is tau 1, and this is 1. H has two terms in it, a thing proportional to the unit operator and a thing proportional to tau 1. And the symbols say E, this is K naught with a tilde over it, and this is a K with a tilde over it times tau 1. So I'm stalling for time while you're thinking about what I just said. I should point out that I had the damnedest trouble getting the tildes over the k's. Any of you that do PowerPoint know that PowerPoint is no damn good for any mathematical symbols, and Keynote, which I used, is a faithful copy of PowerPoint in this regard. It is no damn good for, there's the flicker. It is no damn good for anything involving mathematical symbols. And this particular thing was done in LaTeX and copied in, I think. In any case, I could also do it by defining a tilde and then moving the tilde around very carefully with my, I suffered for you all, really suffered. But this is just stalling so that you figured out, so that you had enough time to see what I said here. What I said here is that this k tilde is something that we're calling the dual of k. Dual is a funny name. It is just that this k tilde is some function of the k we started with. And we went through this set of steps and came up in the end with an e to the k tilde 0 times the unit operator in boldface. Plus k tilde times the operator tau 1 in boldface. This k tilde is some function of the k we started with, and the function is called d of k, so I don't have to suffer indefinitely with putting tildes over things. So d of k is some function of k, and in fact the function is that d of k is the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of k divided by 2. Dual is a particular mathematical name used for a certain kind of function. That function is the one which, if you calculate function of function, if you calculate the dual of k comes back to the same thing. So the d to the minus 1, the functional inverse of d, is the same thing as d. And you go through and calculate what it is to do the hyperbolic tangent, and then do the logarithm, or the inverse hyperbolic tangent of the exponential, and you find that these equations are satisfied. In any case, this is what k tilde is. This has the property that when k is strong, the dual is weak, and vice versa. If k is strong, the hyperbolic tangent is close to 1, and the logarithm is close to 0. If k is weak, that is small, the hyperbolic tangent is a small number, and the logarithm is a large negative number. This then has the property that has been proven to be very important in both statistical physics and particle physics. Often, we know both a basic model and its dual. Often is not as often as we would like, but but happens. Often, that happens almost all the time, models are hard to solve in strong couplings. But the dual models, that is the models which are constructed by, roughly speaking, this argument, but the dual models are weak coupling when the basic models are strong coupling. So then we get an indirect solution of the basic models. Here is the dual coupling as a function of the coupling, as done by my handy-dandy graphing program. When the coupling is weak, the dual coupling is strong. When the coupling is strong, the dual coupling is weak. And if I happen to be missing a minus sign here, I won't die of shock. It's right in the book. Okay, so now we're ready. We can calculate the partition function of the one-dimensional Ising model. How do we calculate the partition function of the one-dimensional Ising model? We converted it into a quantum mechanics problem. The quantum mechanics problem looks like this, looks like that. This chain, the n particle chain, is this quantum mechanics problem raised to the nth power, and then we take the quantum trace. Well, gee, I can do that. The trace is the sum over the eigenvalues in any damn representation I choose to use. Clearly, I should use the representation when tau 1 is diagonal. So tau 1 is either plus 1 or minus 1. Sum over those two cases and then get the trace. If tau 1 is plus 1, I get e to the k plus e to the minus k, which is twice the hyperbolic cosine of k, and that's raised to the nth power. If tau 1 is minus 1, I get e to the k plus e to the minus e to the minus k, and that's the cinch. That, too, is raised to the nth power. And here is the answer for the partition function of the one-dimensional Ising model. In fact, we can do the n goes to infinity limit here very easily. If n is very large, the first term, which involves the hyperbolic cosine, which for positive, for real values of k, is always larger than the, in magnitude than the hyperbolic sine. The first term is larger than the second term, and if it is raised to the nth power, it is much larger than the second term, so that the partition function is then very closely approximated by twice the hyperbolic cosine raised to the nth power. And the free energy, the minus beta, which is the logarithm z, is n times the logarithm of twice the hyperbolic cosine of k. Well, there's a story which goes with all of this. This wasn't the way that the one-dimensional Ising model was first solved. But I'll tell the story anyhow and tell you what was done with the solution. An important physicist by the name of Lenz had a student by the name of Ising. Lenz assigned the Ising, invented probably, the Ising model, and assigned it to the student Ising for his thesis. Lenz asked Ising to solve the model in one dimension and to get an answer for the model. What Lenz was interested in was the phase transition of the one-dimensional Ising model. Well, poor old Ising solved this model. A phase transition is a point of singularity in the partition function, a place where the singularity is not differentiable. And this is differentiable for all values of k. Lenz reported back to Ising reported back to Lenz this result. Ising got his PhD, but was sent off to my home state, Illinois, to be a teacher, and was not only heard of, again, in the titles of several thousand papers, was never exactly heard of again as precisely as a physicist. Here's the solution of the one-dimensional Ising model, with which Ising and Lenz were somewhat disappointed. Okay, this is a hard calculation. It's in the book, it's in the notes, it's carried out very explicitly. In fact, here it is on the blackboard, very explicitly carried out. You may believe that something disappeared up my sleeve at some point, but it isn't true. One can solve most one-dimensional statistical mechanics problems with nearest neighbor coupling by precisely this technique. Questions, comments? Now I'm going to tell you about the analysis of this. I'll tell you about any analysis. Our time is over. Next time, I will tell you about the analysis of this problem. My advice to you is to look at this calculation carefully. Despite the fact that it has its slightly disappointing result, it is a piece of intellectual fireworks, in my opinion. In my opinion, going through this set of steps is this is Feynman's idea as developed by a variety of people, not my stuff. But this is a piece of intellectual fireworks which is worth appreciating what happened here. And I suggest you look carefully at it and try to appreciate it. Next time, we'll calculate the properties of the one-dimensional Ising model. Questions, comments? Okay.
Okay, don't forget to check out the four. I think